13. Put my bag in the front bedroom, Calpurnia, was the first thing Aunt Alexandra said. Jean Louise, stop scratching your head, was the second thing she said. Calpurnia picked up Auntie's heavy suitcase and opened the door. I'll take it, said Jim, and took it. I heard the suitcase hit the bedroom floor with a thump. The sound had a dull permanence about it. Have you come for a visit, Auntie? I asked. Aunt Alexander's visits from the landing were rare, and she traveled in state. She owned a bright green square Buick and a black chauffeur, both kept in an unhealthy state of tidiness, but today they were nowhere to be seen. Didn't your father tell you? She asked. Jim and I shook our heads. Probably he forgot. He's not in yet, is he? No, he doesn't usually get back till late afternoon, said Jim. Well, your father and I decided it was time I came to stay with you for a while. For a while in Macomb meant anything from 3 days to 30 years. Jim and I exchanged glances. Jim's growing up now, and you are too, she said to me. We decided that it would be best for you to have some feminine influence. It won't be many years, Jean Louise, before you become interested in clothes and boys. I could have made several answers to this. Cal's a girl. It would be many years before I would be interested in boys. I would never be interested in clothes. But I kept quiet. What about Uncle Jimmy? Asked Jim. Is he coming too? Oh, no, he's staying at the landing. He'll keep the place going. The moment I said, won't you miss him? I realized that this was not a tactful question. Uncle Jimmy present or Uncle Jimmy absent made not much difference. He never said anything. Aunt Alexandra ignored my question. I could think of nothing else to say to her. In fact, I could never think of anything to say to her, and I sat thinking of past painful conversations between us. How are you, Jean Louise? Fine. Thank you, ma'am. How are you? Very well, thank you. What have you been doing with yourself? Nothing. Don't you do anything? No'm. Certainly you have friends. Yes'm. Well, what do you all do? Nothing. It was plain that Auntie thought me dull in the extreme, because I once heard her tell Atticus that I was sluggish. There was a story behind all this, but I had no desire to extract it from her then. Today was Sunday, and Aunt Alexandra was positively irritable on the Lord's Day. I guess it was her Sunday corset. She was not fat, but solid, and she chose protective garments that drew up her bosom to giddy heights, pinched in her waist, flared out her rear, and managed to suggest that Aunt Alexandra's was once an hourglass figure. From any angle, it was formidable. The remainder of the afternoon went by in the gentle gloom that descends when relatives appear, but was dispelled when we heard a car turn in the driveway. It was Atticus, home from Montgomery. Jim, forgetting his dignity, ran with me to meet him. Jim seized his briefcase and bag. I jumped into his arms, felt his vague, dry kiss, and said, "Did you bring me a book? Did you know Auntie's here?" Atticus answered both questions in the affirmative. "How'd you like for her to come live with us?" I said I would like it very much, which was a lie, but one must lie under certain circumstances and at all times when one can't do anything about them. "We felt it was time you children needed." "Well, it's like this, Scout," Atticus said. "Your aunt's doing me a favor as well as you all. I can't stay here all day with you, and the summer's going to be a hot one." "Yes, sir," I said, not understanding a word he said. I had an idea, however, that Aunt Alexandra's appearance on the scene was not so much Atticus's doing as hers. Auntie had a way of declaring what is best for the family, and I suppose her coming to live with us was in that category. Makeham welcomed her. Miss Maudie Atkinson baked a lane cake so loaded with shinny it made me tight. Miss Stephanie Crawford had long visits with Aunt Alexandra, consisting mostly of Miss Stephanie shaking her head and saying, mm-mm-mm. Miss Rachel next door had Auntie over for coffee in the afternoons, and Mr. Nathan Radley went so far as to come up in the front yard and say he was glad to see her. When she settled in with us and life resumed its daily pace, Aunt Alexandra seemed as if she had always lived with us. Her missionary society refreshments added to her reputation as a hostess. She did not permit Calpurnia to make the delicacies required to sustain the society through long reports on Rice Christians. She joined and became secretary of the Makeham Amanuensis Club. To all parties present and participating in the life of the county, Aunt Alexandra was one of the last of her kind. She had riverboat, boarding school manners. Let any moral come along, and she would uphold it. She was born in the objective case. She was an incurable gossip. When Aunt Alexandra went to school, self-doubt could not be found in any textbook, so she knew not its meaning. She was never bored, and given the slightest chance, she would exercise her royal prerogative. She would arrange, advise, caution, and warn. She never let a chance escape her to point out the shortcomings of other tribal groups to the greater glory of her own, a habit that amused Jim rather than annoyed him. Auntie better watch how she talks. Scratch most folks and make 'em, and they're kin to us. Aunt Alexandra, in underlining the moral of young Sam Merriweather's suicide, said it was caused by a morbid streak in the family. Let a 16-year-old girl giggle in the choir, and Auntie would say, "It just goes to show you, all the Penfield women are flighty." Everybody in Makeham, it seemed, had a streak, a drinking streak, a gambling streak, a mean streak, a funny streak. Once, when Auntie assured us that Miss Stephanie Crawford's tendency to mind other people's business was hereditary, Atticus said, "Sister, when you stop to think about it, our generation's practically the first in the Finch family not to marry its cousins. Would you say the Finches have an incestuous streak?" Auntie said, "No, that's where we got our small hands and feet." I never understood her preoccupation with heredity. Somewhere I had received the impression that fine folks were people who did the best they could with the sense they had, but Aunt Alexandra was of the opinion, obliquely expressed, that the longer a family had been squatting on one patch of land, the finer it was. "That makes the Yules fine folks, then," said Jim. The tribe of which Burris Yule and his brethren consisted had lived on the same plot of earth behind the Makeham dump and had thrived on county welfare money for 3 generations. Aunt Alexandra's theory had something behind it, though. Makeham was an ancient town. It was 20 miles east of Finch's Landing, awkwardly inland for such an old town, but Makeham would have been closer to the river had it not been for the nimble-wittedness of one Sinkfield, who in the dawn of history operated an inn where 2 pig trails met, the only tavern in the territory. Sinkfield, no patriot, served and supplied ammunition to Indians and settlers alike, neither knowing or caring whether he was a part of the Alabama Territory or the Creek Nation so long as business was good. Business was excellent when Governor William Wyatt Bibb, with a view to promoting the newly created county's domestic tranquility, dispatched a team of surveyors to locate its exact center and there establish its seat of government. The surveyors, Sinkfield's guests, told their host that he was in the territorial confines of Macomb County and showed him the probable spot where the county seat would be built. Had not Sinkfield made a bold stroke to preserve his holdings, Macomb would have sat in the middle of Winston Swamp, a place totally devoid of interest. Instead, Macomb grew and sprawled out from its hub, Sinkfield's Tavern, because Sinkfield reduced his guests to myopic drunkenness one evening, induced them to bring forward their maps and charts, lop off a little here, add a bit there, and adjust the center of the county to meet his requirements. He sent them packing next day armed with their charts and 5 quarts of shinny in their saddlebags, 2 apiece and 1 for the governor. Because its primary reason for existence was government, Macomb was spared the grubbiness that distinguished most Alabama towns its size. In the beginning, its buildings were solid, its courthouse proud, its streets graciously wide. Macon's proportion of professional people ran high. One went there to have his teeth pulled, his wagon fixed, his heart listened to, his money deposited, his soul saved, his mules vetted. But the ultimate wisdom of Sinkfield's maneuver is open to question. He placed the young town too far away from the only kind of public transportation in those days, riverboat, and it took a man from the north end of the county 2 days to travel to Macomb for store-bought goods. As a result, the town remained the same size for 100 years, an island in a patchwork sea of cotton fields and timberland. Although Macomb was ignored during the war between the states, Reconstruction rule and economic ruin forced the town to grow. It grew inward. New people so rarely settled there, the same families married the same families until the members of the community looked faintly alike. Occasionally, someone would return from Montgomery or Mobile with an outsider, but the result caused only a ripple in the quiet stream of family resemblance. Things were more or less the same during my early years. There was indeed a caste system in Macomb, but to my mind, it worked this way. The old citizens, the present generation of people who had lived side by side for years and years, were utterly predictable to one another. They took for granted attitudes, character shadings, even gestures, as having been repeated in each generation and refined by time. Thus the dicta, "No Crawford minds his own business," "Every third Merriweather is morbid," "The truth is not in the Delafields," "All the Bufords walk like that," were simply guides to daily living. Never take a check from a Delafield without a discreet call to the bank. Miss Maudie Atkinson's shoulder stoops because she was a Buford. If Mrs. Grace Merriweather sips gin out of Lydia E. Pinkham bottles, it's nothing unusual. Her mother did the same. Aunt Alexandra fitted into the world of Macomb like a hand into a glove, but never into the world of Jim and me. I so often wondered how she could be Atticus's and Uncle Jack's sister that I revived half-remembered tales of changelings and mandrake roots that Jim had spun long ago. These were abstract speculations for the first month of her stay, as she had little to say to Jim and me, and we saw her only at mealtimes and at night before we went to bed. It was summer, and we were outdoors. Of course, some afternoons when I would run inside for a drink of water, I would find the living room overrun with Macomb ladies, sipping, whispering, fanning, and I would be called, "Jean Louise, come speak to these ladies." When I appeared in the doorway, Auntie would look as if she regretted her request. I was usually mud-splashed or covered with sand. "Speak to your cousin Lily," she said one afternoon when she had trapped me in the hall. "Who?" I said. Your cousin Lily Brooke, said Aunt Alexandra. She our cousin? I didn't know that. Aunt Alexandra managed to smile in a way that conveyed a gentle apology to Cousin Lily and firm disapproval of me. When Cousin Lily Brooke left, I knew I was in for it. It was a sad thing that my father had neglected to tell me about the Finch family or to install any pride into his children. She summoned Jim, who sat warily on the sofa beside me. She left the room and returned with a purple-covered book on which Meditations of Joshua S. St. Clair was stamped in gold. Your cousin wrote this, said Aunt Alexandra. He was a beautiful character. Jim examined the small volume. Is this the cousin Joshua who was locked up for so long? Aunt Alexandra said, How did you know that? Why, Attica said he went round the bend at the university, said he tried to shoot the president, said Cousin Joshua said he wasn't anything but a sewer inspector and tried to shoot him with an old flintlock pistol, only it just blew up in his hand. Attica said it cost the family $500 to get him out of that one. Aunt Alexandra was standing stiff as a stork. That's all, she said. We'll see about this. Before bedtime, I was in Jim's room trying to borrow a book when Atticus knocked and entered. He sat on the side of Jim's bed, looked at us soberly, then he grinned. Ahem, he said. He was beginning to preface some things he said with a throaty noise, and I thought he must at last be getting old. But he looked the same. I don't exactly know how to say this, he began. Well, just say it, said Jim. Have we done something? Our father was actually fidgeting. No, I just want to explain to you that your Aunt Alexandra asked me. Son, you know you're a Finch, don't you? That's what I've been told. Jim looked out of the corners of his eyes. His voice rose uncontrollably. Atticus, what's the matter? Atticus crossed his knees and folded his arms. I'm trying to tell you the facts of life. Jim's disgust deepened. I know all that stuff, he said. Atticus suddenly grew serious. In his lawyer's voice, without a shade of inflection, he said, Your aunt has asked me to try and impress upon you and Jean Louise that you are not from run-of-the-mill people, that you are the product of several generations' gentle breeding. Atticus paused, watching me locate an elusive red bug on my leg. Gentle breeding, he continued when I had found and scratched it, and that you should try to live up to your name. Atticus persevered in spite of us. She asked me to tell you, you must try to behave like the little lady and gentleman that you are. She wants to talk to you about the family and what it's meant to Macomb County through the years, so you'll have some idea of who you are, and so you might be moved to behave accordingly, he concluded at a gallop. Stunned, Jim and I looked at each other, then at Atticus, whose collar seemed to worry him. We did not speak to him. Presently, I picked up a comb from Jim's dresser and ran its teeth along the edge. Stop that noise, Atticus said. His curtness stung me. The comb was midway in its journey, and I banged it down. For no reason, I felt myself beginning to cry, but I could not stop. This was not my father. My father never thought these thoughts. My father never spoke so. Aunt Alexandra had put him up to this somehow. Through my tears, I saw Jim standing in a similar pool of isolation, his head cocked to one side. There was nowhere to go, but I turned to go and met Atticus's vest front. I buried my head in it and listened to the small internal noises that went on behind the light blue cloth. his watch ticking, the faint crackle of his starched shirt, the soft sound of his breathing. "Your stomach's growling," I said.
"I know it," he said. "You better take some soda."
"I will," he said.
"Atticus, is all this behaving and stuff going to make things different? I mean, are you..." I felt his hand on the back of my head.
"Don't you worry about anything," he said. "It's not time to worry."
When I heard that, I knew he had come back to us. The blood in my legs began to flow again, and I raised my head. "You really want us to do all that? I can't remember everything Finchers are supposed to do."
"I don't want you to remember it. Forget it."
He went to the door and out of the room, shutting the door behind him. He nearly slammed it, but caught himself at the last minute and closed it softly. As Jim and I stared, the door opened again, and Atticus peered around. His eyebrows were raised. His glasses had slipped. "Get more like Cousin Joshua every day, don't I? Do you think I'll end up costing the family $500? I know now what he was trying to do, but Atticus was only a man. It takes a woman to do that kind of work. 14. Although we heard no more about the Finch family from Aunt Alexandra, we heard plenty from the town. On Saturdays, armed with our nickels, when Jim permitted me to accompany him, he was now positively allergic to my presence when in public, we would squirm our way through sweating sidewalk crowds and sometimes hear, "There's his chillin', or yonder some Finches." Turning to face our accusers, we would see only a couple of farmers studying the enema bags in the Mayco drugstore window, or two dumpy country women in straw hats sitting in a Hoover cart. "They can go loose and rape up the countryside for all of them who run this county care," was one obscure observation we met head-on from a skinny gentleman when he passed us, which reminded me that I had a question to ask Atticus. "What's rape?" I asked him that night. Atticus looked around from behind his paper. He was in his chair by the window. As we grew older, Jim and I thought it generous to allow Atticus 30 minutes to himself after supper. He sighed and said rape was carnal knowledge of a female by force and without consent. "Well, if that's all it is, why did Calpurnia dry me up when I asked her what it was?" Atticus looked pensive. "What's that again?" "Well, I asked Calpurnia coming from church that day what it was, and she said ask you, but I forgot to, and now I'm asking you." His paper was now in his lap. "Again, please," he said. I told him in detail about our trip to church with Calpurnia. Atticus seemed to enjoy it, but Aunt Alexandra, who was sitting in a corner quietly sewing, put down her embroidery and stared at us. "You all were coming back from Calpurnia's church that Sunday?" Jim said, "Yes'm, she took us." I remembered something. "Yes'm, and she promised me I could come out to her house some afternoon. Atticus, I'll go next Sunday if it's all right, can I? Cal said she'd come get me if you were off in the car." "You may not." Aunt Alexandra said it. I wheeled around, startled, then turned back to Atticus in time to catch his swift glance at her. But it was too late. I said, "I didn't ask you." For a big man, Atticus could get up and down from a chair faster than anyone I ever knew. He was on his feet. "Apologize to your aunt," he said.
"I didn't ask her. I asked you."
Atticus turned his head and pinned me to the wall with his good eye. His voice was deadly. "First, apologize to your aunt." "I'm sorry, Auntie," I muttered. "Now then," he said, "let's get this clear.
You do as Calpurnia tells you. You do as I tell you. And as long as your aunt's in this house, you will do as she tells you. Understand? I understood, pondered a while, and concluded that the only way I could retire with a shred of dignity was to go to the bathroom, where I stayed long enough to make them think I had to go. Returning, I lingered in the hall to hear a fierce discussion going on in the living room. Through the door, I could see Jim on the sofa with a football magazine in front of his face, his head turning as if its pages contained a live tennis match. "You've got to do something about her," Auntie was saying. "You've let things go on too long, Atticus, too long." "I don't see any harm in letting her go out there. Cal'd look after her there as well as she does here." Who was the her they were talking about? My heart sank. Me. I felt the starched walls of a pink cotton penitentiary closing in on me, and for the second time in my life I thought of running away immediately. "Atticus, it's all right to be soft-hearted. You're an easy man, but you have a daughter to think of, a daughter who's growing up." "That's what I am thinking of." "And don't try to get around it. You've got to face it sooner or later, and it might as well be tonight. We don't need her now." Atticus's voice was even. "Alexandra, Calpurnia's not leaving this house until she wants to. You may think otherwise, but I couldn't have got along without her all these years. She's a faithful member of this family, and you'll simply have to accept things the way they are. Besides, sister, I don't want you working your head off for us. You've no reason to do that. We still need Cal as much as we ever did." "But, Atticus, besides, I don't think the children have suffered one bit from her having brought them up. If anything, she's been harder on them in some ways than a mother would have been. She's never let them get away with anything. She's never indulged them the way most colored nurses do. She tried to bring them up according to her lights, and Cal's lights are pretty good. And another thing, the children love her." I breathed again. It wasn't me. It was only Calpurnia they were talking about. Revived, I entered the living room. Atticus had retreated behind his newspaper, and Aunt Alexandra was worrying her embroidery. Punk, punk, punk. Her needle broke the taut circle. She stopped and pulled the cloth tighter. Punk, punk, punk. She was furious. Jim got up and padded across the rug. He motioned me to follow. He led me to his room and closed the door. His face was grave. "They've been fussing, Scout. Jim and I fussed a great deal these days, but I'd never heard of or seen anyone quarrel with Atticus. It was not a comfortable sight. Scout, try not to antagonize Auntie, hear?" Atticus's remarks were still rankling, which made me miss the request in Jim's question. My feathers rose again. "You trying to tell me what to do?" "Nah, he's got a lot on his mind now without us worrying him." "Like what?" Atticus didn't appear to have anything especially on his mind. "It's this Tom Robinson case that's worrying him to death." I said Atticus didn't worry about anything. Besides, the case never bothered us except about once a week, and then it didn't last. "That's because you can't hold something in your mind but a little while," said Jim. "It's different with grown folks. We..." His maddening superiority was unbearable these days. He didn't want to do anything but read and go off by himself. Still, everything he read he passed along to me, but with this difference. Formerly because he thought I'd like it. Now for my edification and instruction. "Gee, crawling hova, Jim. Who do you think you are?" Now, I mean it, Scout. You antagonize Annie, and I'll spank you. With that, I was gone. You damn Morphidot, I'll kill you. He was sitting on the bed, and it was easy to grab his front hair and land one on his mouth. He slapped me, and I tried another left, but a punch in the stomach sent me sprawling on the floor. It nearly knocked the breath out of me, but it didn't matter because I knew he was fighting. He was fighting me back. We were still equals. "Ain't so high and mighty now, are you?" I screamed, sailing in again. He was still on the bed, and I couldn't get a firm stance, so I threw myself at him as hard as I could, hitting, pulling, pinching, gouging. What had begun as a fist fight became a brawl. We were still struggling when Atticus separated us. "That's all," he said. "Both of you go to bed right now." "Ta," I said to Jim. He was being sent to bed at my bedtime. "Who started it?" asked Atticus in resignation. "Jim did. He was trying to tell me what to do. I don't have to mind him now, do I?" Atticus smiled. "Let's leave it at this. You mind Jim whenever he can make you. Fair enough." Aunt Alexandra was present but silent, and when she went down the hall with Atticus, we heard her say, "Just one of the things I've been telling you about," a phrase that united us again. Ours were adjoining rooms. As I shut the door between them, Jim said, "Night, Scout." "Night," I murmured, picking my way across the room to turn on the light. As I passed the bed, I stepped on something warm, resilient, and rather smooth. It was not quite like hard rubber, and I had the sensation that it was alive. I also heard it move. I switched on the light and looked at the floor by the bed. Whatever I had stepped on was gone. I tapped on Jim's door. "What?" he said. "How does a snake feel?" "Sort of rough, cold, dusty." "Why?" "I think there's one under my bed. Can you come look?" "Are you being funny?" Jim opened the door. He was in his pajama bottoms. I noticed not without satisfaction that the mark of my knuckles was still on his mouth. When he saw I meant what I said, he said, "If you think I'm going to put my face down to a snake, you got another think coming. Hold on a minute." He went to the kitchen and fetched the broom. "You better get up on the bed," he said. "You reckon it's really one?" I asked. This was an occasion. Our houses had no cellars. They were built on stone blocks a few feet above the ground, and the entry of reptiles was not unknown, but was not commonplace. Miss Rachel Haverford's excuse for a glass of neat whiskey every morning was that she never got over the fright of finding a rattler coiled in her bedroom closet on her washing when she went to hang up her negligee. Jim made a tentative swipe under the bed. I looked over the foot to see if a snake would come out. None did. Jim made a deeper swipe. "The snake's grunt?" "It ain't a snake," Jim said. "It's somebody." Suddenly, a filthy brown package shot from under the bed. Jim raised the broom and missed Dill's head by an inch when it appeared. "God Almighty!" Jim's voice was reverent. We watched Dill emerge by degrees. He was a tight fit. He stood up and eased his shoulders, turned his feet in their ankle sockets, rubbed the back of his neck. His circulation restored, he said, "Hey." Jim petitioned God again. I was speechless. "I'm about to perish," said Dill. "Got anything to eat?" In a dream, I went to the kitchen. I brought him back some milk and half a pan of cornbread left over from supper. Dill devoured it, chewing with his front teeth, as was his custom. I finally found my voice. "How'd you get here?" "By an involved route." Refreshed by food, Dill recited this narrative. Having been bound in chains and left to die in the basement, there were basements in Meridian, by his new father, who disliked him, and secretly kept alive on raw field peas by a passing farmer who heard his cries for help. The good man poked a bushel, pod by pod, through the ventilator. Dill worked himself free by pulling the chains from the wall. Still in wrist manacles, he wandered 2 miles out of Meridian, where he discovered a small animal show and was immediately engaged to wash the camel. He traveled with the show all over Mississippi until his infallible sense of direction told him he was in Abbott County, Alabama, just across the river from Macomb. He walked the rest of the way. "How'd you get here?" asked Jim. He had taken $13 from his mother's purse, caught the 9 o'clock from Meridian, and got off at Macomb Junction. He had walked 10 or 11 of the 14 miles to Macomb, off the highway in the scrub bushes, lest the authorities be seeking him, and had ridden the remainder of the way, clinging to the backboard of a cotton wagon. He had been under the bed for 2 hours, he thought. He had heard us in the dining room, and the clink of forks on plates nearly drove him crazy. He thought Jim and I would never go to bed. He had considered emerging and helping me beat Jim, as Jim had grown far taller. But he knew Mr. Finch would break it up soon, so he thought it best to stay where he was. He was worn out, dirty beyond belief, and home. "They must not know you're here," said Jim. "We'd know if they were looking for you." "Think they're still searching all the picture shows in Meridian," Dill grinned. "You ought to let your mother know where you are," said Jim. "You ought to let her know you're here." Dill's eyes flickered at Jim, and Jim looked at the floor. Then he rose and broke the remaining code of our childhood. He went out of the room and down the hall. "Atticus?" His voice was distant. "Can you come here a minute, sir?" Beneath its sweat-streaked dirt, Dill's face went white. I felt sick. Atticus was in the doorway. He came to the middle of the room and stood with his hands in his pockets, looking down at Dill. I finally found my voice. "It's okay, Dill. When he wants you to know something, he tells you." Dill looked at me. "I mean, it's all right," I said. "You know he wouldn't bother you. You know you ain't scared of Atticus."
"I'm not scared," Dill muttered. "Just hungry, I'll bet."
Atticus's voice had its usual pleasant dryness. "Scout, we can do better than a pan of cold cornbread, can't we? You fill this fella up, and when I get back, we'll see what we can see. Mr. Finch, don't call Aunt Rachel. Don't make me go back, please, sir. I'll run off again."
"Whoa, son," said Atticus. "Nobody's about to make you go anywhere but to bed pretty soon. I'm just over to tell Miss Rachel you're here and ask her if you could spend the night with us. You'd like that, wouldn't you? And for goodness sake, put some of the county back where it belongs. The soil erosion's bad enough as it is."
Dill stared at my father's retreating figure. "He's trying to be funny," I said. "He means take a bath. See there? I told you he wouldn't bother you." Jim was standing in a corner of the room, looking like the traitor he was. "Dill, I had to tell him," he said. "You can't run 300 miles off without your mother knowing." We left him without a word. Dill ate and ate and ate. He hadn't eaten since last night. He used all his money for a ticket, boarded the train as he had done many times, coolly chatted with the conductor, to whom Dill was a familiar sight. But he had not the nerve to invoke the rule on small children traveling a distance alone. If you've lost your money, the conductor will lend you enough for dinner, and your father will pay him back at the end of the line. Dill made his way through the leftovers and was reaching for a can of pork and beans in the pantry when Miss Rachel's "Do Jesus!" went off in the hall. He shivered like a rabbit.
He bore with fortitude her "wait till I get you home, your folks are out of their minds worrying," was quite calm during "that's all the Harrison you coming out," smiled at her "reckon you can stay one night," and returned the hug at long last bestowed upon him. Atticus pushed up his glasses and rubbed his face. "Your father's tired," said Aunt Alexandra, her first words in hours, it seemed. She had been there, but I suppose struck dumb most of the time. "You children get to bed now." We left them in the dining room, Attica still mopping his face. "From rape to riot to runaways," we heard him chuckle. "I wonder what the next 2 hours will bring." Since things appear to have worked out pretty well, Dill and I decided to be civil to Jim. Besides, Dill had to sleep with him, so we might as well speak to him. I put on my pajamas, read for a while, and found myself suddenly unable to keep my eyes open. Dill and Jim were quiet. When I turned off my reading lamp, there was no strip of light under the door to Jim's room. I must have slept a long time, for when I was punched awake, the room was dim with the light of the setting moon. "Move over, Scout." "He thought he had to," I mumbled. "Don't stay mad with him." Dill got in bed beside me. "I ain't," he said. "I just wanted to sleep with you. Are you waked up?" By this time I was, but lazily so. "Why'd you do it?" No answer. I said, "Why'd you run off? Was he really hateful like you said?" "Nah." "Didn't you all build that boat like you wrote you were gonna?" "He just said we would. We never did." I raised up on my elbow, facing Dill's outline. "It's no reason to run off. They don't get around to doing what they say they're going to do half the time." "That wasn't it. They just wasn't interested in me." This was the weirdest reason for flight I'd ever heard. "How come?" "Well, they stayed gone all the time, and when they were home even, they'd get off in a room by themselves." "What'd they do in there?" "Nothing. Just sitting and reading. But they didn't want me with them." I pushed the pillow to the headboard and sat up. "You know something? I was fixing to run off tonight because there they all were. You don't want them around all the time, Dill." Dill breathed his patient breath, a half sigh. "Good night. Atticus is gone all day and sometimes half the night and off in the legislature and I don't know what. You don't want them around all the time, Dill. You couldn't do anything if they were." "That's not it." As Dill explained, I found myself wondering what life would be if Jim were different, even from what he was now. What I would do if Atticus did not feel the necessity of my presence, help, and advice. Why, he couldn't get along a day without me. Even Calpurnia couldn't get along unless I was there. They needed me. "Dill, you ain't telling me right. Your folks couldn't do without you. They must be just mean to you. Tell you what to do about that." Dill's voice went on steadily in the darkness. "The thing is, what I'm trying to say is, they do get on a lot better without me. I can't help them any. They ain't mean. They buy me everything I want, but it's, 'Now you've got it, go play with it. You've got a room full of things. I got you that book, so go read it.'" Dill tried to deepen his voice. "You're not a boy. Boys get out and play baseball with other boys. They don't hang around the house worrying their folks." Dill's voice was his own again. "Oh, they ain't mean. They kiss you and hug you good night and good morning and goodbye and tell you they love you. Scout, let's get us a baby." "Where?" There was a man Dill had heard of who had a boat that he rowed across to a foggy island where all these babies were. You could order one. "That's a lie. Annie said God drops them down the chimney. At least that's what I think she said. For once, Auntie's diction had not been too clear. "Well, that ain't so. You get babies from each other. But there's this man, too. He has all these babies just waiting to wake up. He breathes life into them."
Dill was off again. Beautiful things floated around in his dreamy head. He could read 2 books to my 1, but he preferred the magic of his own inventions. He could add and subtract faster than lightning, but he preferred his own twilight world, a world where babies slept, waiting to be gathered like morning lilies. He was slowly talking himself to sleep and taking me with him, but in the quietness of his foggy island, there rose the faded image of a gray house with sad brown doors.
"Dill?
Hmm?
Why do you reckon Boo Radley's never run off?"
Dill sighed a long sigh and turned away from me. "Maybe he doesn't have anywhere to run off to."
15. After many telephone calls, much pleading on behalf of the defendant, and a long forgiving letter from his mother, it was decided that Dill could stay. We had a week of peace together. After that, little, it seemed. A nightmare was upon us. It began one evening after supper. Dill was over. Aunt Alexandra was in her chair in the corner. Atticus was in his. Jim and I were on the floor reading. It had been a placid week. I had minded Auntie. Jim had outgrown the treehouse, but helped Dill and me construct a new rope ladder for it. Dill had hit upon a foolproof plan to make Boo Radley come out at no cost to ourselves. Place a trail of lemon drops from the back door to the front yard, and he'd follow it like an ant. There was a knock on the front door. Jim answered it and said it was Mr. Heck Tate.
"Well, ask him to come in," said Atticus. "I already did. There's some men outside in the yard. They want you to come out."
In Macomb, grown men stood outside in the front yard for only 2 reasons, death and politics. I wondered who had died. Jim and I went to the front door, but Atticus called, "Go back in the house." Jim turned out the living room lights and pressed his nose to a window screen. Aunt Alexandra protested.
"Just for a second, Auntie. Let's see who it is," he said.
Dill and I took another window. A crowd of men were standing around Atticus. They all seemed to be talking at once. "Moving him to the county jail tomorrow," Mr. Tate was saying. "I don't look for any trouble, but I can't guarantee there won't be any."
"Don't be foolish, Heck," Atticus said. "This is Macomb. Said I was just uneasy."
"Heck, we've gotten 1 postponement of this case just to make sure there's nothing to be uneasy about."
"This is Saturday," Atticus said. "Trial'll probably be Monday. You can keep him 1 night, can't you?"
"I don't think anybody in Macomb'll begrudge me a client with times this hard."
There was a murmur of glee that died suddenly when Mr. Link Dees said,
"Nobody around here's up to anything. It's that old Sarum bunch I'm worried about.
Can't you get a... what is it, Heck?"
"Change of venue," said Mr. Tate.
"Not much point in that, now is it?"
Atticus said something inaudible. I turned to Jim, who waved me to silence.
"Besides," Atticus was saying, "you're not scared of that crowd, are you? Know how they do when they get shinnied up. They don't usually drink on Sunday. They go to church most of the day," Atticus said.
"This is a special occasion, though," someone said.
They murmured and buzzed until Auntie said if Jim didn't turn on the living room lights, he would disgrace the family. Jim didn't hear her.
"Don't see why you touched it in the first place," Mr. Link Dees was saying. "You've got everything to lose from this, Atticus. I mean everything." Do you really think so? This was Atticus's dangerous question. Do you really think you want to move there, Scout? Bam, 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 and the checkerboard was swept clean of my men. Do you really think that, son? Then read this. Jim would struggle the rest of an evening through the speeches of Henry W. Grady. Link, that boy might go to the chair, but he's not going till the truth's told. Atticus's voice was even, and you know what the truth is. There was a murmur among the group of men, made more ominous when Atticus moved back to the bottom front step and the men drew nearer to him. Suddenly Jim screamed, "Atticus, the telephone's ringing!" The men jumped a little and scattered. They were people we saw every day, merchants, in-town farmers. Dr. Reynolds was there. So was Mr. Avery. "Well, answer it, son," called Atticus. Laughter broke them up. When Atticus switched on the overhead light in the living room, he found Jim at the window, pale except for the vivid mark of the screen on his nose. "Why on earth are you all sitting in the dark?" he asked. Jim watched him go to his chair and pick up the evening paper. I sometimes think Atticus subjected every crisis of his life to tranquil evaluation behind the Mobile Register, the Birmingham News, and the Montgomery Advertiser. "They were after you, weren't they?" Jim went to him. "They wanted to get you, didn't they?" Atticus lowered the paper and gazed at Jim. "What have you been reading?" he asked. Then he said gently, "No, son. Those were our friends." "It wasn't a gang?" Jim was looking from the corners of his eyes. Atticus tried to stifle a smile, but didn't make it. "No, we don't have mobs and that nonsense in Macomb. I've never heard of a gang in Macomb." "Ku Klux got after some Catholics one time." "Never heard of any Catholics in Macomb either," said Atticus. "You're confusing that with something else. Way back about 1920 there was a Klan, but it was a political organization more than anything. Besides, they couldn't find anybody to scare. They paraded by Mr. Sam Levy's house one night, but Sam just stood on his porch and told them things had come to a pretty pass. He'd sold them the very sheets on their backs. Sam made them so ashamed of themselves they went away. The Levy family met all criteria for being fine folks. They did the best they could with the sense they had, and they had been living on the same plot of ground in Macomb for 5 generations. "The Ku Klux is gone," said Atticus. "It'll never come back." I walked home with Dill and returned in time to overhear Atticus saying to Auntie, "In favor of Southern womanhood as much as anybody, but not for preserving polite fiction at the expense of human life," a pronouncement that made me suspect they had been fussing again. I sought Jim and found him in his room, on the bed, deep in thought. "Have they been at it?" I asked. "Sort of. She won't let him alone about Tom Robinson. She almost said Atticus was disgracing the family. Scout, I'm scared." "Scared of what?" "Scared about Atticus. Somebody might hurt him." Jim preferred to remain mysterious. All he would say to my questions was, "Go on and leave him alone." Next day was Sunday. In the interval between Sunday school and church, when the congregation stretched its legs, I saw Atticus standing in the yard with another knot of men. Mr. Heck Tate was present, and I wondered if he had seen the light. He never went to church. Even Mr. Underwood was there. Mr. Underwood had no use for any organization but the Macomb Tribune, of which he was the sole owner, editor, and printer.
His days were spent at his linotype, where he refreshed himself occasionally from an ever-present gallon jug of cherry wine. He rarely gathered news. People brought it to him. It was said that he made up every edition of the Macon Tribune out of his own head and wrote it down on the linotype. This was believable. Something must have been up to haul Mr. Underwood out. I caught Atticus coming in the door, and he said that they'd moved Tom Robinson to the Macon jail. He also said, more to himself than to me, that if they'd kept him there in the first place, there wouldn't have been any fuss. I watched him take his seat on the third row from the front, and I heard him rumble, "Nearer, my God, to thee," some notes behind the rest of us. He never sat with Auntie, Jim, and me. He liked to be by himself in church. The fake peace that prevailed on Sundays was made more irritating by Aunt Alexandra's presence. Atticus would flee to his office directly after dinner, where if we sometimes looked in on him, we would find him sitting back in his swivel chair reading. Aunt Alexandra composed herself for a 2-hour nap and dared us to make any noise in the yard. The neighborhood was resting. Jim, in his old age, had taken to his room with a stack of football magazines, so Dill and I spent our Sundays creeping around in Deer's pasture. Shooting on Sundays was prohibited, so Dill and I kicked Jim's football around the pasture for a while, which was no fun. Dill asked if I'd like to have a poke at Boo Radley. I said I didn't think it'd be nice to bother him and spent the rest of the afternoon filling Dill in on last winter's events. He was considerably impressed. We parted at supper time, and after our meal, Jim and I were settling down to a routine evening when Atticus did something that interested us. He came into the living room carrying a long electrical extension cord. There was a light bulb on the end. "I'm going out for a while," he said. "You folks will be in bed when I come back, so I'll say good night now." With that, he put his hat on and went out the back door. "He's taking the car," said Jim. Our father had a few peculiarities. One was he never ate desserts. Another was that he liked to walk. As far back as I could remember, there was always a Chevrolet in excellent condition in the car house, and Atticus put many miles on it in business trips, but in Macon he walked to and from his office 4 times a day, covering about 2 miles. He said his only exercise was walking. In Macon, if one went for a walk with no definite purpose in mind, it was correct to believe one's mind incapable of definite purpose. Later on, I bade my aunt and brother good night and was well into a book when I heard Jim rattling around in his room. His go-to-bed noises were so familiar to me that I knocked on his door. "Why ain't you going to bed?" "I'm going downtown for a while." He was changing his pants. "Why? It's almost 10 o'clock, Jim." He knew it, but he was going anyway. "Then I'm going with you. If you say no, you're not. I'm going anyway, here." Jim saw that he would have to fight me to keep me home, and I suppose he thought a fight would antagonize Auntie, so he gave in with little grace. I dressed quickly. We waited until Auntie's light went out, and we walked quietly down the back steps. There was no moon tonight. "Dill will want to come," I whispered. "So he will," said Jim gloomily. We leaped over the driveway wall, cut through Miss Rachel's side yard, and went to Dill's window. Jim whistled Bob White. Dill's face appeared at the screen, disappeared, and 5 minutes later he unhooked the screen and crawled out. An old campaigner, he did not speak until we were on the sidewalk. "What's up?" "Jim's got the look arounds," an affliction Calpurnia said all boys caught at his age. "I've just got this feeling," Jim said, "just this feeling." We went by Mrs. DeBose's house.
standing empty and shuttered, her camellias grown up in weeds and Johnson grass. There were 8 more houses to the post office corner. The south side of the square was deserted. Giant monkey puzzle bushes bristled each corner, and between them an iron hitching rail glistened under the streetlights. A light shone in the county toilet. Otherwise, that side of the courthouse was dark. A larger square of stores surrounded the courthouse square. Dim lights burned from deep within them. Atticus's office was in the courthouse when he began his law practice, but after several years of it, he moved to quieter quarters in the Macomb Bank building. When we rounded the corner of the square, we saw the car parked in front of the bank. "He's in there," said Jim. But he wasn't. His office was reached by a long hallway. Looking down the hall, we should have seen Atticus Finch, attorney at law, in small, sober letters against the light from behind his door. It was dark. Jim peered in the bank door to make sure. He turned the knob. The door was locked. "Let's go up the street. Maybe he's visiting Mr. Underwood." Mr. Underwood not only ran the Macomb Tribune office, he lived in it. That is, above it. He covered the courthouse and jailhouse news simply by looking out his upstairs window. The office building was on the northwest corner of the square, and to reach it, we had to pass the jail. The Macomb jail was the most venerable and hideous of the county's buildings. Atticus said it was like something Cousin Joshua St. Clair might have designed. It was certainly someone's dream. Starkly out of place in a town of square-faced stores and steep-roofed houses, the Macomb jail was a miniature Gothic joke, 1 cell wide and 2 cells high, complete with tiny battlements and flying buttresses. Its fantasy was heightened by its red brick facade and the thick steel bars at its ecclesiastical windows. It stood on no lonely hill, but was wedged between Tyndall's hardware store and the Macomb Tribune office. The jail was Macomb's only conversation piece. Its detractors said it looked like a Victorian privy. Its supporters said it gave the town a good, solid, respectable look, and no stranger would ever suspect that it was full of niggers. As we walked up the sidewalk, we saw a solitary light burning in the distance. "That's funny," said Jim. "Jail doesn't have an outside light." "Looks like it's over the door," said Dill. A long extension cord ran between the bars of a second-floor window and down the side of the building. In the light from its bare bulb, Atticus was sitting propped against the front door. He was sitting in one of his office chairs, and he was reading, oblivious of the night bugs dancing over his head. I made to run, but Jim caught me. "Don't go to him," he said. "He might not like it." "He's all right. Let's go home." I just wanted to see where he was. We were taking a shortcut across the square when 4 dusty cars came in from the Meridian Highway, moving slowly in a line. They went around the square, past the bank building, and stopped in front of the jail. Nobody got out. We saw Atticus look up from his newspaper. He closed it, folded it deliberately, dropped it in his lap, and pushed his hat to the back of his head. He seemed to be expecting them. "Come on," whispered Jim. We streaked across the square, across the street, until we were in the shelter of the Jitney Jungle door. Jim peeked up the sidewalk. "We can get closer," he said. We ran to Tyndall's hardware door, near enough, at the same time discreet. In 1s and 2s, men got out of the cars. Shadows became substance as light revealed solid shapes moving toward the jail door. Atticus remained where he was. The men hid him from view. "He in there, Mr. Finch?" a man said. He is, we heard Atticus answer, and he's asleep. Don't wake him up. In obedience to my father, there followed what I later realized was a sickeningly comic aspect of an unfunny situation. The men talked in near whispers. You know what we want, another man said. Get aside from the door, Mr. Finch. You can turn around and go home again, Walter, Atticus said pleasantly. Heck Tate's around somewhere. The hell he is, said another man. Heck's bunch is so deep in the woods they won't get out until morning. Indeed? Why so?
Called 'em off on a snipe hunt, was the succinct answer.
Didn't you think of that, Mr. Finch? Thought about it, but didn't believe it. Well, then, my father's voice was still the same. That changes things, doesn't it?
It do, another deep voice said. Its owner was a shadow. Do you really think so?
This was the second time I heard Atticus ask that question in 2 days, and it meant somebody's man would get jumped. This was too good to miss. I broke away from Jim and ran as fast as I could to Atticus. Jim shrieked and tried to catch me, but I had a lead on him and Dill. I pushed my way through dark, smelly bodies and burst into the circle of light. Hey, Atticus! I thought he would have a fine surprise, but his face killed my joy. A flash of plain fear was going out of his eyes, but returned when Dill and Jim wriggled into the light. There was a smell of stale whiskey and pig pen about, and when I glanced around, I discovered that these men were strangers. They were not the people I saw last night. Hot embarrassment shot through me. I had leaped triumphantly into a ring of people I had never seen before. Atticus got up from his chair, but he was moving slowly, like an old man. He put the newspaper down very carefully, adjusting its creases with lingering fingers. They were trembling a little. Go home, Jim, he said. Take Scout and Dill home. We were accustomed to prompt, if not always cheerful, acquiescence to Atticus's instructions. But from the way he stood, Jim was not thinking of budging. Go home, I said. Jim shook his head. As Atticus's fists went to his hips, so did Jim's, and as they faced each other, I could see little resemblance between them. Jim's soft brown hair and eyes, his oval face and snug-fitting ears, were our mother's. Contrasting oddly with Atticus's graying black hair and square-cut features, but they were somehow alike. Mutual defiance made them alike. Son, I said, go home. Jim shook his head. I'll send him home, a burly man said, and grabbed Jim roughly by the collar. He yanked Jim nearly off his feet. Don't you touch him! I kicked the man swiftly. Barefooted, I was surprised to see him fall back in real pain. I intended to kick his shin, but aimed too high. That'll do, Scout. Atticus put his hand on my shoulder. Don't kick folks. No, he said, as I was pleading justification. Ain't nobody gonna do Jim that way, I said. All right, Mr. Finch, get 'em out of here, someone growled. You got 15 seconds to get 'em out of here. In the midst of this strange assembly, Atticus stood trying to make Jim mind him. I ain't going, was his steady answer to Atticus's threats, requests, and finally, please, Jim, take them home. I was getting a bit tired of that, but felt Jim had his own reasons for doing as he did, in view of his prospects once Atticus did get him home. I looked around the crowd. It was a summer's night, but the men were dressed most of them in overalls and denim shirts buttoned up to the collars. I thought they must be cold-natured as their sleeves were unrolled and buttoned at the cuffs. Some wore hats pulled firmly down over their ears. They were sullen-looking, sleepy-eyed men who seemed unused to late hours. I sought once more for a familiar face, and at the center of the semicircle I found one. "Hey, Mr. Cunningham!" The man did not hear me, it seemed. "Hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's your entailment getting along?" Mr. Walter Cunningham's legal affairs were well known to me. Atticus had once described them at length. The big man blinked and hooked his thumbs in his overall straps. He seemed uncomfortable. He cleared his throat and looked away. My friendly overture had fallen flat. Mr. Cunningham wore no hat, and the top half of his forehead was white in contrast to his sun-scorched face, which led me to believe that he wore one most days. He shifted his feet, clad in heavy work shoes. "Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one time, remember?" I began to sense the futility one feels when unacknowledged by a chance acquaintance. "I go to school with Walter," I began again. "He's your boy, ain't he? Ain't he, sir?" Mr. Cunningham was moved to a faint nod. He did know me after all. "He's in my grade," I said, "and he does right well. He's a good boy," I added, "a real nice boy. We brought him home for dinner one time. Maybe he told you about me. I beat him up one time, but he was real nice about it. Tell him hey from me, won't you?" Atticus had said it was the polite thing to talk to people about what they were interested in, not about what you were interested in. Mr. Cunningham displayed no interest in his son, so I tackled his entailment once more in a last-ditch effort to make him feel at home. "Entailments are bad," I was advising him, when I slowly awoke to the fact that I was addressing the entire aggregation. The men were all looking at me. Some had their mouths half open. Atticus had stopped poking at Jim. They were standing together beside Bill. Their attention amounted to fascination. Atticus's mouth, even, was half open, an attitude he had once described as uncouth. Our eyes met, and he shut it.
"Well, Atticus, I was just saying to Mr. Cunningham that entailments are bad and all that, but you said not to worry. It take a long time sometimes, that you all'd ride it out together."
I was slowly drying up, wondering what idiocy I had committed. Entailments seemed all right enough for living room talk. I began to feel sweat gathering at the edges of my hair. I could stand anything but a bunch of people looking at me. They were quite still. "What's the matter?" I asked. Atticus said nothing. I looked around and up at Mr. Cunningham, whose face was equally impassive. Then he did a peculiar thing. He squatted down and took me by both shoulders. "I'll tell him you said hey, little lady," he said. Then he straightened up and waved a big paw. "Let's clear out," he called. "Let's get going, boys." As they had come, in ones and twos, the men shuffled back to their ramshackle cars. Doors slammed, engines coughed, and they were gone. I turned to Atticus, but Atticus had gone to the jail and was leaning against it with his face to the wall. I went to him and pulled his sleeve. "Can we go home now?" He nodded, produced his handkerchief, gave his face a going-over, and blew his nose violently. "Mr. Finch?" A soft,
husky voice came from the darkness above. They gone? Atticus stepped back and looked up. They've gone, he said. Get some sleep, Tom. They won't bother you any more. From a different direction, another voice cut crisply through the night. You damn tootin', they won't. Had you covered all the time, Atticus. Mr. Underwood and a double-barreled shotgun were leaning out his window above the Macomb Tribune office. It was long past my bedtime, and I was growing quite tired. It seemed that Atticus and Mr. Underwood would talk for the rest of the night, Mr. Underwood out the window and Atticus up at him. Finally, Atticus returned, switched off the light above the jail door, and picked up his chair. "Can I carry it for you, Mr. Finch?" asked Dill. He had not said a word the whole time. "Why, thank you, son." Walking toward the office, Dill and I fell into step behind Atticus and Jim. Dill was encumbered by the chair, and his pace was slower. Atticus and Jim were well ahead of us, and I assumed that Atticus was giving him hell for not going home. But I was wrong. As they passed under a street light, Atticus reached out and massaged Jim's hair, his one gesture of affection.